Dear Dr. Teicher,
Drs. Cronin and Jenkins, I appreciate this opportunity that you are giving me to describe my events at the University of Wisconsin and the importance that it has had on my career. I hope that you will find the information of interest and usable. Since I want you to have an authentic picture, I'm going to use names of professors and very specific events. Thus, if you use some of these, I would appreciate your obtaining the permission of the person before you use their name, since some of the material I discuss could be very sensitive. Thank you. To begin the story, my name is Robert Edward Lyle, Jr., and I was born on January 26, 1926, at Emory Wesley Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. My parents were Adeline Cason Lyle and Robert Edward Lyle, who had only a year before been admitted to the South Georgia Conference of what is now the United Methodist Church. He was himself a South Georgian and was therefore returning to his homeland and as a circuit minister. As my early education and my early life was spent in very rural or small towns in Georgia, and as a minister's son, moved approximately every 2-3 years. Therefore, I had a number of different schools that I attended and a number of different towns that I could call home. My first education was received in Eatonton, Georgia, where I reached the age of 5, and unfortunately they would not allow me to enter the first grade because my birthday was after December. As a consequence, my mother taught me at home reading and elementary subjects until my father moved in December to Grovetown, Georgia, which is a suburb of Augusta, Georgia. There his circuit covered about 4 churches, but the school was a very small school, elementary school, with about 4 teachers, and they allowed me to enter the first grade. I remained in Grovetown for about 3 years, and again in December we moved to Union Point, Georgia, which is a little larger city, and the school was a little larger, so that each class had its own room. I stayed at Union Point for 2 years and then moved to Bethlehem, Georgia, which is a small, very small town, close to Winder, Georgia, which is about 60 miles from Atlanta, east of Atlanta. There I attended a one-room schoolhouse which had 3 to 4 grades in one room. And this was the time that I went through the remaining elementary school grades and through junior high. At the end of 4 years, I entered the senior high school at Winder, Georgia, but I was there only 3 months until my father again moved, this time to Thompson, Georgia, which is about 40 miles northwest of Augusta. There, the high school was much larger, but still had only 11 grades, as most of the rural Georgia schools did. So, as a consequence, since I started at 5 years, and since I only went for 11 years, I completed my high school degree at 16, and since my parents felt that I was perhaps a little young for attending a large school, they recommended and sent me to Emory Junior College, which is located in Oxford, Georgia. It is an academy plus a two-year school at that time. And fortunately, there was a very good chemistry professor there, Dr. Fousey, as he was known, Marion Clark, who later became department chairman at Agnes Scott College in Atlanta. But his influence on me as a beginning chemistry student was very profound and solidified my interest in majoring in chemistry. At the end of my first year, this was the period when the war was beginning, and as a consequence, and draft, of course, was taking place. So this, as a result, Dr. Clark was going to involve himself in defense research and advised my parents to move me from the junior college to Atlanta branch of Emory University, which was the larger university branch. So in 1943, I left Oxford and went to Emory in Atlanta. There I was influenced very strongly by two organic chemistry professors, Dr. Charles T. Lester and Dr. Osborne Quayle. I completed my bachelor's degree in 1945, and at that point I was only 19 years old, and everyone felt it would be well for me to remain one more year at Emory and obtain a master's degree. I worked for Dr. Quayle on a research project, and during that time, both of the organic chemistry professors arranged for my graduate work. They suggested that I apply to Indiana University, University of North Carolina, and the University of Wisconsin. When I received an offer of a teaching assistantship at the University of Wisconsin, they immediately said, "Do not hesitate and wait for the others, but simply accept the Wisconsin offer." I had never been further away from home than a few miles without my family, and so my family had long consultations with the faculty at Emory about whether or not this really was the thing to do. And they finally convinced my family, and therefore convinced me, that I should go to the University of Wisconsin. I turned down the offer at the University of Indiana, which came later, and I never heard from North Carolina. The preparations for Wisconsin, of course, were quite extensive because in Atlanta, Georgia, one has limited access to the kinds of clothes that you would need at Wisconsin with the cold winters. But I did finally get a fur-lined coat and some boots which would satisfy the snow, and a hat which later I lost and almost frozen here, but that's another story. I have jumped over the role of the World War II in my education, but I think that it did have some significance, so I will inject it as a parenthetical statement here. I registered for the draft while I was a student at Emory University. I neglected to say that my father had, in the meantime, moved to Roswell, Georgia, which is just north of Atlanta. And so as I entered Emory in Atlanta, I also commuted from Roswell, and needless to say, I seldom saw home in the daylight because of the commuting requirement. But at any rate, I registered for the draft in Roswell, Georgia, and immediately applied for the V-12 Navy program. When I went for my physical examination, the doctors recognized that my left arm was about 2 inches shorter than my right because of a break in the elbow that I'd had back when I was in the elementary school in Grovetown, Georgia. They therefore denied my admission into the V-12 program. They suggested some other alternatives, and I searched those alternatives, including even the possibility of transferring my major from chemistry to physics in order to get into one of the Navy programs. But unfortunately, none of these were acceptable because of my arm. Then when I was not available for the Navy, I was asked to appear at the Army headquarters for a medical examination for admission to the Army. And again, the presence of my arm disability, which really was little disability, kept me from being drafted. Jumping way ahead, when the Korean conflict occurred, I had already entered my professional career, as I will mention later, and there it became very touchy as to whether or not I would be drafted, because apparently the medical requirements were not nearly so stringent for that conflict. And so I carried a deferment for a year, and then I carried a 1A card for some time. Fortunately for me, I never was drafted, but it was a very close situation there. Now, returning to the history of my life, I then moved to University of Wisconsin, where I spent 3 years, and I will describe those in detail. At the end of that 3 years, I graduated with the PhD degree, and at the advice of my mentor, Dr. Sam McElvain, I applied for teaching positions. At the University of Nebraska, I almost was considered. I think it was between another person and myself, and the other person got the offer. The only other position that was circulating that year was at Oberlin College, and I have many stories that I could tell about my interview at Oberlin College, going out on the train in a roomette, which I had never done before, and all of the interesting problems that entailed. But finally, and my interview, in which the chairman of the department said that organic chemists were a dime a dozen, why should he hire me? And it required some rather fast talking. But in any event, I obtained that position for a salary of $3,750 a year. And for 2 years, my wife and I were able to exist in Oberlin, mainly on the savings which she had accumulated during our stay at Wisconsin. But finally it became too much, and the failure to be able to do any reasonable research at Oberlin required us to move. And so I resigned without another position, and we left, went to Emory Junior College for a summer appointment, which I had to teach chemistry. And during that summer, we had a very interesting series of correspondence with the chairman of the chemistry department at the University of New Hampshire, who himself was on a vacation holiday driving to the West Coast. So our communications went back and forth across the United States. Without an interview, and without my ever seeing the University of New Hampshire or talking with their faculty, I accepted a position there as assistant professor of chemistry. We arrived, and as a surprise to the rest of the faculty, and I apparently must have proved satisfactory, because we then proceeded through the ranks of assistant, associate, and full professor at the University of New Hampshire. Incidentally, my wife was also put part-time on the staff, but given professorial rank. She was never tenured, but she did reach the level of full professor during her stay there. She also incidentally received her PhD degree there. During my stay at the University of New Hampshire, I had 32 doctoral students graduate with PhDs. I had 22 postdoctorals work with me, and I had 31 master's degrees completed there. But after the University of New Hampshire, with 25 years, the economic situation began to deteriorate in the late 70s. So I began to look at other parts of the country, and primarily in Texas because of the Welch Foundation, which supports chemical research at the academic institutions. I looked at the Texas Tech University and then at the University of North Texas, which at that time was called North Texas State University. I was offered chairmanship there and accepted it. My wife then received an appointment at the Associated Medical School, the Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine. We stayed there for 2.5 years, and I would have remained there had it not been by a fortuitous circumstance. One of the alumni of Texas Tech had the need for a vice president at Southwest Research Institute, and he called me and offered me the opportunity to apply for that position. I knew little about Southwest Research Institute, but after a little investigation, decided to accept the position, and my wife and I moved to San Antonio, and where we have remained through my retirement about 2 years ago. My wife taught at Trinity College for 1 year, and then at the University of Texas in San Antonio, which is a rather large branch of the University of Texas in Austin. There are, that she again was not on a tenure track appointment, but had a very exciting opportunity there. So this then provides you, I believe, with most of the summary of my career and my interest in academics, but for you, it is much more important to discuss University of Wisconsin. So let's return to that question. As I mentioned, the faculty at Emory University felt that the University of Wisconsin was probably the major university in the United States which had top people in all fields of chemistry. Harvard University would be similar. University of Illinois had very good people in the field of organic chemistry, but not in some of the other fields. That was true of Indiana, and Stanford at that time was a very second-rate university. Berkeley was reasonable, but again, that was a very long way away from home. The major professors at that time were in organic chemistry, were Homer Atkins, Samuel McIlvaine, William Johnston, and Alfred Wiles. In inorganic chemistry, there was Dr. Sorum, Dr. Holt, and in analytical, Dr. Melange, Dr. Daniels. The financial aspects of the University of Wisconsin proved fairly satisfactory because the teaching assistants were paid about $1,100 a year for the 9 month period, with additional salaries during the summer. I had a teaching assistantship for the first 2 years that I was there. And then the third year, I applied for and received a Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation fellowship for $870 for the academic year. Fortunately, all along, our financial state was supplemented by my wife working for Dr. Van Potter in the McArdle Cancer Research Institute. And there are many stories I could tell about this because it always antagonized me that they published so frequently in the McArdle, so that she received a publication with her name long before I had a chance to get a publication in chemistry. I discovered unions very early because by the time I arrived at the University of Wisconsin, the offer which I accepted for a teaching assistantship had been raised approximately $75 a year because of the teachers' union negotiation with the University of Wisconsin. The first year I was at the University of Wisconsin, I was single, and my wife was teaching at a small girls' school in Virginia. And in order to ensure financial assistance, I made an attempt to join an all-girls orchestra at Madison. Fortunately for them and for me, it never worked out because I wanted to sing the same song that somebody else that was already in their orchestra wanted to sing. So fortunately for all of us, it didn't work. I did receive some supplements to my salary by tutoring. Particularly, it was valuable for me to tutor to the athletic groups because I could talk to a number of them at once, which meant that the hourly wage was quite significant. So this did help supplement. I might also add that even though it was not a question of financial remuneration, the way in which I financed my first year included peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and liverwurst sandwiches, which constituted much of my diet that first year. Although a number of us would on occasion go over to the Memorial Union and have a little bit more sustenance. The first year that I was at Wisconsin, I stayed at the University Club, which was directly across from the University Library. The reason that I was there goes back to my days at Emory University, because my roommate at Emory University, who was 1 year ahead of me in undergraduate school, graduated with his master's at the same time. And he also, with considerable help from Dr. Quayle and Dr. Lester, obtained a teaching assistantship at the University of Wisconsin, primarily through Dr. Homer Adkins. It turns out that even though I roomed with Carol Bailey, was his name, I did not particularly like him. And so, as a consequence, it was with a great deal of reluctance that I accepted the possibility of rooming with Carol at the University Club. But again, our professors had worked out this arrangement through their contacts at Wisconsin, and this satisfied my mother and father much. So I accepted my Carol as my roommate and stayed at the University Club. Incidentally, I might just point out at this point that the fact that I worked for Dr. McIlvaine for my PhD was partly determined by my dislike for Carol Bailey. The two major professors that we had heard about at Emory were Dr. Adkins and Dr. McIlvaine. So I decided that I would wait and see which of the two faculty Carol Bailey chose to work for, and then I would work for the other one. So Carol worked for Dr. Adkins, and I then immediately chose Dr. McIlvaine. I don't recall exactly what my costs were at the University Club, but as I remember, it was not out of line with what I had paid at Emory University, so it was feasible for me to stay there. They did have meals there, but I did find them rather expensive. So I seldom ate at the University Club, except when I was sick, and they were very kind to even give me room service at that time. When my wife and I returned married in 1947, the story was slightly different. We arrived in Madison by train with no car, and we started investigating all of the possible housing units. Not being a veteran, I was not eligible for Badger Village or any of the other veteran housing, and as a consequence, we found that the town was quite crowded. We were staying at the hotel on the square. I can't recall the name, but we stayed there for several nights, and our funds were rapidly deteriorating. So since my father was a Methodist minister, I checked with the minister of the Methodist Church there in Madison, and he was kind enough to suggest that we come and stay with them for a while. So we did, and we had set a limit of 1 week, and if we did not find a place at that time, we would leave. About the middle of that period, we obtained, or we heard from one of our inquiries, that Dr. Ralph Bing, who was in the math department at that time, had a large house which he had divided up into two upstairs apartments in addition to his living space downstairs, that the person who was going to take the larger of those two apartments had reneged and was not going to. So we immediately rushed over, found a two-room apartment with a shared bath that was unfurnished for $75 a month, which, as you see from our $1,200 or thereabouts for an assistantship, represented a large part of our budget. We accepted this and then went immediately to buy secondhand furniture. Fortunately, the minister's wife had an old stove, gas stove, and some other things which we purchased, and finally we had a fairly comfortable apartment. The Beings, of course, were most delightful to live with, and he being on the faculty provided a very satisfactory environment for us to have. The other couple in the apartment in front were also graduate students, in their case in mathematics, and so we had a very congenial time in that apartment. They moved the same time we finished. They moved to the University of Texas as we moved to Oberlin College. So that worked out quite conveniently. I mentioned Badger Village. I did have some friends who lived there, and about all I can say is that it was most inconvenient because the distance from the campus meant that the people there did not have the opportunity for evening work in the laboratory, which most of us required. They did not have the opportunity to visit the library as easily as we did. And as I mentioned in my letter to you, one of the snowstorms which we had that was particularly bad prevented them from coming, prevented the buses from running from Badger Village, and therefore caused the cancellation of classes on the campus, one of the rare times that that happened. As a matter of fact, it was so rare that we graduate students were in the laboratory, those of us who could walk there, and we decided that we did not really want to go to class, but we would send one of our colleagues to visit Dr. Johnson's class, Dr. William Johnson's class, to see if he really was going to cancel it. His response, as I recall, was that such holidays as these were for undergraduates and not for graduate students. But since none of us had showed up, he had to give in and did not hold class that day, although I think we all lost some points in his eyes as a result. Beginning the course of study in the graduate school of the chemistry department at the University of Wisconsin, I required the passing of qualifying examinations in three of the four major areas of study, that is, organic chemistry, physical chemistry, analytical chemistry, and inorganic or general chemistry. Dr. McIlvaine advised me to take the organic chemistry and nothing else, or at most to take general chemistry as a second choice. But being very butt-headed, I thought, well, since I had just had the physical chemistry course, I had better take the physical chemistry exam. And as you might guess, I flunked it. So as a consequence, I ended my first year there with A's in organic chemistry, a B in physical chemistry, an A and a B in general chemistry, passed one of the qualifying courses in organic chemistry, and had flunked the physical chemistry. You are allowed a second chance for any of these examinations, and so obviously when I returned married, one of the first things I had to do was to pass the physical chemistry qualifier. After a great deal of study and exertion, I took the exam and was completely convinced that I had flunked it a second time. I, as a matter of fact, discussed with Dr. McIlvaine the possibility of transferring from Wisconsin to Illinois, and he insisted that I should wait and find out the results before I made such a drastic change. Well, my memory of that examination was that my wife saw Dr. Farrington Daniels leave his office carrying a list of the exam results, which he was going to post. My wife asked what the results were. He said, "What is your name?" She said, "Lyle." He said, "You passed." And so my wife said she almost kissed him, but considering Dr. Daniels, that might have been a very serious mistake. In any event, we got over that hurdle. There was no problem with the inorganic, since I had been teaching that course for about a year at that time. As a result, then, the major hurdle past that point was the courses in organic chemistry, a second course in inorganic chemistry, and of course, passing two language exams, German and French, and finally, the doctoral exams, which come at the end of your stay. During my first year there, the courses, particularly in organic chemistry, were team taught by three or four of the organic chemists. Dr. Atkins taught a very, at the beginning, organic course, which was an intermediate level. And I passed that one easily with an A, since it was duplicating much of the material I'd had at Emory. The second course was team taught by Drs. Wiles, Drs. Johnson, and Dr. McIlvaine. Dr. Wiles taught stereochemistry, and I, even though that later became my specialty, I had a great deal of difficulty with his course, and I ended up with a B in that segment. Dr. McIlvaine taught a very interesting course in physical organic chemistry, which I did well in. And Dr. Johnson, who was lovingly called Black Bill Johnson because of his unidirectional interest in organic research, was very compatible with me for some reason. On one examination at the end of his segment of the course, I made a 100, a perfect score, but I happened to be away the day that he returned those papers. Some of my, quote, friends, unquote, got my paper for me and doctored it so that I showed only a 79 on the exam. And so even though they later told me it was a joke, I went to Dr. Johnson to confirm it, and of course he said, yes, that was a perfect paper and it was good. And so he was rather upset, I think, that some of my colleagues had taken liberties with the paper. As a matter of fact, that created a friendship which has lasted to the present time, that Dr. Johnson and I have had many, many interactions since that time. As a matter of fact, probably one of the most significant events resulted from an interaction with Dr. Johnson. At the time that I was at Wisconsin and earlier, my father's influence on me caused me not to accept any alcoholic beverages. And so, but against his better judgment, I took up smoking, unfortunately. And so for many years, I smoked but did not have any alcoholic beverages. Well, at one national meeting, Dr. Johnson and I, and Gloria, my wife, who also smoked, met with Dr. Johnson. It was very hot. We all piled into our car and drove over to the to a local bar where he ordered an alcoholic beverage and we ordered Cokes. And he said a profound statement which I later took to heart and adopted, and that was, you've got this all wrong. You should take up drinking and give up smoking. And I have found that to be a very wise advice. With regard to the interaction with the other graduate students, probably the most profound interactions resulted among the group that were teaching assistants and among the group with which worked for your major professor. So, as a consequence, the my major friends were those who were also teaching assistants in the general chemistry course under the direction of Dr. Aaron Ide. And Dr. Ide was a very nice person. And so we were most upset when he was replaced by Dr. Willard for handling the teaching assistants. One of the major concerns we had was that we had a practice of playing bridge in the teaching assistants room during the lunch hour, when presumably students were not supposed to come in and bother us. We had quite a tournament going, as a matter of fact, since most of the graduate assistants did play bridge. When Dr. Willard took over the responsibility for the teaching assistants, he stated that he did not feel that it was professional for us to use the lunch hour playing bridge, and in effect forbade the use of card in the instructor's room. We came very close to declaring a strike, and fortunately it never came to a decision because Dr. Willard relented and we went back to our bridge tournament. There was a serious concern about grades and passing the examinations, but it did not extend to a competition among or between the graduate students, but rather a complementary attempt for us to learn together. So there were, as I recall, few, if any, enmities that developed among the graduate students in chemistry. The chemistry department, of course, had a formal seminar which required each of us to present a seminar once a year. And I will comment on one of my seminars, since I think it does show somewhat the interaction with the faculty. I had gotten to know some of the people at McArdle because of my wife being there, And so Charlie Heidelberg, who was one of the chemists in the group at McArdle, decided he would come to my seminar in the chemistry department, and which dealt with the formation of salts, of pyridinium formation of pyridinium compounds, and bordered on a theoretical discussion of organic chemistry. So Dr. Heidelberg asked at the end of my seminar, just what significance this work that I described had in the field of chemistry. And without giving a serious thought, I said, well, it contributed to an understanding of the theoretical aspects of organic chemistry. Whereupon Dr. Homer Atkins said, Mr. Lyle, do you ever make a distinction between theories and hypotheses? And of course, I was not very articulate, so my response was, hardly ever. Fortunately, I was not reprimanded for my smarting answer. The doctoral exams were our major concern, and so we spent a great deal of time going over the background of the organic seminars, going over old examinations, going over seminar speakers, material, and any other, and much of the current literature, particularly review articles. We would collaborate on our studies so that we could expand our coverage by having a group interaction. Again, this was important either in among the teaching assistant group, or even more important, among the group that were working for Dr. McElveen. At the very end of my stay, Dr. McElveen began to have a seminar regarding his research activities. This, however, played very little part in the overall examination system of the department, but it was most important in our learning of the field of organic chemistry and the design of research problems, which proved most significant to me in later life. I'm sure that there were significant campus politics at the University of Wisconsin in the chemistry department, but I was not of such a nature that I searched these out, and it was not particularly obvious to me. I suspect now that my passing the physical chemistry examination may have been influenced by some pressure by Dr. McElveen, but I don't know. I also suspect that there was a great deal of conflict and perhaps competition, severe competition, between Dr. Wiles and Dr. Johnson. If so, obviously Dr. Johnson came out ahead, because he certainly had developed a much more rapid reputation in the field of organic chemistry than Dr. Wiles, even though Dr. Wiles had a head start after his degree. As you can tell, I enjoyed my stay at Wisconsin very much, and I felt that I had received, one, a very good education, both in terms of knowledge of chemistry, but also in terms of how to solve chemical problems and how to deal with graduate students and other faculty, which I needed in later life. I felt that the department treated its graduate students very fairly. They did not keep them too well. As a matter of fact, since I was there only 3 years, or actually 2.5 years, I felt that they were quite fair in getting you out rapidly if you were vigorous in your pursuit of your research. I felt that they were fair in their coursework. I felt that in every respect, even to the foreign language examinations, I felt that the other departments were quite fair in dealing with us. We were not particularly encouraged to attend national meetings. I'm sure there was no discouragement, but there was an American Chemical Society meeting in Chicago, and even though I went, I did not attend any of the papers, nor was there much encouragement for us to do this. Also, there was a local American Chemical Society section, and we were notified of the topics of the discussion, but not particularly encouraged to attend. I specifically remember that two of my graduate student friends and I went to a American Chemical Society meeting lecture on infrared spectroscopy, and we got up at about the first 15 or 20 minutes and said, "We see no particular application for this." As you may be aware, infrared spectroscopy turned out to be one of the most important early methods for determining organic structures, and certainly many of the fine details of organic structure. As I mentioned, I selected Dr. McIlvain for my thesis mentor primarily because Carol Bailey selected Dr. Adkins. But I never regretted that choice. As a matter of fact, the only other person I think I would have enjoyed working for would have been Dr. Johnson. This is continued on the other side. Dr. McIlvain had three sets of areas of research. The Dr. McIlvain had three sets of areas of research. The isolation and characterization of the active component of catnip oil, ketene acetals, and piperidine derivatives. The piperidine derivatives are known for their potential physiological action, and this potential use as a pharmaceutical attracted my attention and led me to choose that area for research. The title of my thesis was Synthesis of 1-methyl-4-piperidylidene Derivatives, for whatever that may mean. But actually, I was not able to prepare the final product which we wanted, which was a derivative of Demerol. But we were able to make the piperidylidene intermediates and show why they would not undergo reaction to form the desired derivative of Demerol. The structure determinations I used for some of the subtle isomeric structures was rather primitive physical measurements by today's standards, and I think now with all of the instrumentation that we have available now, how quickly I could have solved that whole problem and gone on to some more interesting studies. Dr. McIlvain was most important in helping me design and carry out the research project. The research committee that I had was of very little importance, even to the extent that I don't think Dr. McIlvain allowed them to ask very many questions at my final exam. The final oral exam was held in his office and contained all of the committee there. And they were very sympathetic, very congenial, and it was an enjoyable experience. Your mentioning the question of examinations, however, reminds me of the doctoral examination, which is a written exam all day long. The morning session was more or less factual information. The afternoon session was an attempt to have us apply information that we had been taught to new types of circumstances. I can remember the morning exam specifically again because Dr. Johnson was our monitor. And at that time, there was really a birth of new physical organic chemistry, which involved the study of kinetics of organic reaction. One of the major terms that were used to describe replacement reactions was the initials SN1 and SN2. When I saw these on the examination, I vaguely remembered what they were, and so to be sure, I went out and asked Dr. Johnson, would he please tell me what SN1 and SN2 stood for? He said, Bob, they stand for substitution nucleophilic of the first order, substitution nucleophilic of the second order, and if you don't know that, you probably don't know the answer to that question. Well, as it turned out, I vaguely remembered something about that, and I made some good guesses, and it turned out that my guesses were correct. At any rate, the doctoral exam was passed with no significant problem. Turning now to clubs and organizations, actually the only clubs that I was involved with were those related to the chemistry department. There's a national fraternity for chemical research called Sigma Psi, and I was initiated into that fraternity the first year I was there, and unfortunately it does not have very many activities during the course of the year, so I really didn't spend much time at their meetings, but it was an important membership for me. As it turned out, therefore, I was a charter member and an establishing member of the Sigma Psi chapter at the University of New Hampshire. I did not have any particular association with the student publication. I did read the Daily Cardinal quite frequently and was impressed by its frequency, since the idea of a daily newspaper from the university was a unique idea compared to the weekly or monthly publication at Emory. The leisure time that we had, I've already referred to with regard to our bridge playing at noon. Occasionally, the first year before I was married, occasionally we would go to a movie. Particularly, we were enticed by the big bands which came to Madison and would play at the downtown theaters. Wally Runge, another graduate student, and myself would frequently spend an afternoon at the theater to hear the big band's play, since we were both interested in jazz. I think I attended one theater production at Wisconsin, but there was not a great deal of leisure time, and particularly after I was married, about once a week we would go to the movies, and that was about the only time I had off from studies or research. There were no activities, sporting or otherwise, that I involved in, except fishing. The fact that there were so many lakes around Madison, and the fact that we lived very close to Lake Winona, led to sometimes in the afternoon, after a busy day at lab, going down to the lake and fly fishing for bluegills. The graduate students had taught me a little about the fly fishing, and I found it to be probably the most exciting sport that I had other than chemistry. I had very little interest in politics before I went to Wisconsin, and even there, but I did find it interesting that I was exposed to a new concept at Wisconsin, and that was one of socialism. One of my colleagues that worked for Dr. McIlvaine Bob McMahon, introduced me to the idea of socialism, and apparently there was an election on campus, a selection on campus of various topics, and he encouraged me to go over and cast my vote as a socialist, even though I really had very little understanding of the whole concept or the whole meaning. Now, during 1946 and 1947, I was interested in football at University of Wisconsin, primarily because I had never been at a school that had a football team before. We had season tickets for one or two of the years that I was there to the football games, and unfortunately that was one of the years in which Wisconsin had a very losing team. It was so bad that toward the end of the season, the stands would begin to chant, "Goodbye, Harry," and show signs that said, "Goodbye, Harry," referring to the coach, Harry Stooldryer, who was really a very poor coach with that particular team. The football team itself became very angry with the stands, and one time I saw them actually start to leave the bench and go up into the stands to try to quiet the crowd and remove the banners which said, "Goodbye, Harry." The first year I was at Wisconsin, I did attend one of the basketball games and was very impressed with the quality of Big Ten basketball. I believe, the game between Ohio State and Wisconsin, and was probably one of the most exciting basketball games I've ever seen. Other than participation in a few pickup basketball games and a few pickup football games, that was the extent of my athletic activities while I was at Wisconsin. As you can guess from the quality of the football team, it was not very impressive in getting students to attend. With regard to discrimination, that is an interesting question because I came from the South immediately to Wisconsin, and other than the fact that I still carried a very strong Southern accent, which led to many embarrassing encounters, I really did not suffer from any particular discrimination. The many of my colleagues made fun of my accent, but it was all good-natured, and so as a consequence, I did not feel repressed or seriously upset. There was one instance, however, which I do think might be worth mentioning with regard to discrimination which I encountered with one of my friends. As you have mentioned, there were occasions when several of us would get together to go to the union for lunch, particularly the graduate students who were assisting. Following lunch, we would occasionally, that first year I was in Wisconsin, go back to the university club and avail ourselves of the facilities of pool or billiards down in the game room, which was on the first basement floor. Without really seriously thinking about the problem, one day when we had one of our female teaching assistants along with us, I invited the group to come over to the university club to play pool, and we were going to teach her some of the fine points of the game. And so we went down to the basement area and started playing. Well, we had completed about half of the game when Dr. Holt from the chemistry department, who was also a member of the university club, came over to me and said, "You realize that you have seriously breached the etiquette and rules of the university club." And I obviously expressed ignorance of the whole thing. And it turned out that there was a very serious concern among the members of the group that I had brought a young lady downstairs into the game room. So as soon as I passed the word to our group, they immediately said, well, let's go back to the Union and play our game over there. So we left, and that was the last time I had any occasion to bring anyone to the University Club, and it was one of the last times that I played any of the games in the game room. With regard to discrimination within the chemistry department, there might be some discrimination against women, since there were not very many women graduates, although there were some. The many of the graduate students who were females stopped at the master's degree rather than the PhD, but that happened to many of the males as well, who didn't pass exams and so forth. So I have no real knowledge of whether this was discriminatory or just accidental. Because there was such a mixture of students who were returning as veterans, I seriously doubt that there was any significant discrimination, because we represented quite a cross-section of beliefs and races and genders. With regard to campus or departmental personalities, I've mentioned a number of these. Dr. Daniels, who was the department chairman, had very little interaction with us except in the physical chemistry discipline. The more direct influence was our research director, Dr. McIlvain, or the organic chemistry group, which I've mentioned, the four chemists, or occasionally we would have some interaction with the director of the general chemistry, who was in charge of the teaching assistants. But I did meet the dean on my graduation day, because my family came to Wisconsin for my graduation. It happened to be the centennial year, and so there was a great deal of fanfare at that graduation ceremony. The dean met as well as the president, the families of the graduates, and so as a consequence, that was my only contact with the upper administration. But there were many campus personalities. One stands out in particular, and I think I should give some little attention to him. He was a biochemist by the name of K.P. Link, L-I-N-K-E. His field was carbohydrate chemistry, and so he taught one segment of the course in organic chemistry to the chemistry department, and it was an optional segment, but all of us who had heard from other graduate students about him immediately signed up for the course, because he was such an interesting character. Particularly for a Southerner from Georgia, it was an experience to know that you were standing in the presence of a card-carrying communist. I have often wondered why Joe McCarthy, when he was senator from Wisconsin, never investigated K.P. Link, as far as I know. And yet, K.P. Link was an avowed communist. As a matter of fact, in his references to various chemical journals that we were to read, there would be references to Marx and to other communist papers and books. But in spite of his political beliefs, he was a very, very interesting character. He knew Emil Fischer's family well, and so had many, many interesting stories about Emil Fischer, but also was an interesting character in his own. Two stories I can think of specifically. One was that there was to be an oral examination, a thesis examination, which was going to be controversial because the student had apparently not completed the research in a satisfactory manner. So K.P. Link expected the oral to be a long one. And in the middle of the examination, after about an hour and a half of grilling, he put his briefcase on the desktop and opened it up and pulled from the briefcase a thermos bottle and a sandwich and proceeded to have a lunch, expressing, I'm sure, his disdain for the other committee members and their continued grilling of the poor student. His interest in students, I think, was represented by that kind of demonstration. But also, in his course, he would frequently do rather unusual things. And one of these, since the students recognize this, one day his class on the second floor looked out the window and saw this bottle of beer coming down attached to a string, being lowered from the third floor window. K.P. Link, without batting an eyelash, went over to the window, opened it, pulled the bottle of beer inside, and made a comment, "Gee, I wish I had a bottle opener." And so, within a few seconds, a second string came down from the third floor with a bottle opener on the end. He reached out, opened up the window, pulled in the bottle opener, and opened up the bottle of beer, and proceeded to drink it during the course of the lecture. This was the kind of informal atmosphere that he had in his classroom, and it was very exciting to those of us who were still impressionable in our educational learning. During my period at the University of Wisconsin, I of course received a great deal of enthusiasm about research and contributing original knowledge to the field of chemistry. In addition to that, the association with Dr. Ide further increased my interest in education and academic institutions. By the time I had finished my degree at Wisconsin, I wanted to enter an academic institution, and I would like to progress rapidly, of course, through the ranks to full professor, but also I had great desires to accomplish fundamental research, preferably by instruction of graduate students, particularly PhD candidates. Dr. McElveen discussed this with me many times and was influential in guiding me to first accept the position at Oberlin, and perhaps more importantly, after I found Oberlin unsatisfactory, was influential in obtaining my position at the University of New Hampshire. During my period at Wisconsin, there were a number of instances when there were not sufficient students to be interviewed by industrial interviewers, and so I was asked, even though I was not interested, to go ahead and interview with these industrial clients. It is interesting that I was offered interview trips on several occasions, but my buttheadedness and extreme desire to enter academia prevented me from even taking an interview trip, although the particular industries knew that my main emphasis was academic. As you can see from my history in academia, I felt that I did achieve the goals that I had set by progressing even to department chairman, which I did not find as satisfying as I thought I might. Furthermore, I had the opportunity then of a second career in a private research institute, which my degree at Wisconsin, I think, prepared me for, even though it has been many, many years in the past. Obviously, at a research institute, one must not be a specialist, but a generalist. And the importance of the degree at Wisconsin was the fact that it was a general degree in chemistry, although a very strong and important emphasis in organic chemistry. Although it touches on several questions which you've asked, I might go back and mention the fact that at the time I was getting my degree, organic chemistry was proceeding from a strictly synthetic activity to a theoretical approach using kinetics and other physical techniques to discuss and to determine the way in which organic reactions occurred. It was opportune that the year I finished, the Organic Symposium, the National Organic Symposium, met at Madison. And of course, as a graduate student, I was participating very heavily in the social aspects as well as the chemical and technical aspects of the program. People like Weinstein and Brown and Cram were all important on the program and were the pace setters for this new approach to organic chemistry. And this made a very strong impression on my future work, as well as at that time to emphasize the importance of academic chemistry. I might just say as an aside, during that event, Professor Adkins, playing golf with some of the participants of the symposium, had a heart attack, which proved fatal. This really concludes the major part of my discussion of my stay at Wisconsin, but there were a few humorous incidences which happened, which I thought you might find of interest. One of the days that I was working on my second floor laboratory in the old chemistry building, I heard the fire sirens and I looked out the window, and sure enough, the fire trucks pulled up in front of the chemistry building. And here we were surrounded by tanks of hydrogen, hydrogenation equipment, solvents which were flammable, and other dangerous aspects of a very flammable wooden building. And yet, our interest was simply to see what the fire trucks were doing. Without ever leaving, we finally discovered that one of the physical chemists, Dr. Paul Bender, had a heater in one of his constant temperature baths catch the alcohol, which was the coolant, on fire and created a little bit of stir on the first floor. But we, as experienced firefighters in organic chemistry, were not particularly disturbed. Since we were on the second floor of the chemistry building, we overlooked the tennis courts, which were just outside of our building. And you can imagine that during the summer, in the beautiful sunshine, there would be a number of people watching the tennis games and sunning themselves on blankets on the grass. And so we would take a great deal of interest in the scenery, but we also had a little bit of mischief, because we would take the very, very pressure, very, very thick pressure tubing and stuff it filled with dry ice, solid carbon dioxide, and then very carefully seal both ends with clamps and throw it out in the sun, hopefully without getting the attention of the people outside. As the sun caused the carbon dioxide to evaporate, of course, it filled up the pressure tubes and ultimately would give off a great big bang, and we then would watch the startled people near the tennis courts. Now, this later proved to be sort of the detriment of one of my colleagues, actually the fellow who was working on catnip oil. He was not a very outstanding student, and so it's not surprising that he was one of the ringleaders on a very rainy day to throw potassium out of the laboratory window so that it would land on the water in the tennis court and burst into very violent flame. A footnote to this is that we, of course, over a period of time, gathered a lot of scrap sodium in our lab. And so on weekends, we frequently, well, not very frequently, but when we had enough scrap sodium to fill one of our small glass jars, would cover it over with an oil-soaked rag, and then throw it off one of the bridges into the large lake. What usually happened was that after a while, the water would seep through into the sodium. It would then surface the bottle, and a big flame would shoot out, usually a yellow flame because of the sodium. And then after a while, the bottle would sink again. It would fill up with water. Hydrogen would develop, and it again would float, let off a big yellow flame. And this continued for several minutes. I'm sure now that we would probably, well, even then, we might have been put in jail if anyone had watched us. But fortunately, we avoided detection at that time. Now, they're also, you remember that we were a fairly young bunch, even though we did have a lot of older veterans in our group. But we were fairly normal males, and so as a consequence, the secretary of Dr. McElveen, who obviously was important to us because of appointments and typing and other functions that were valuable to the graduate students, we had quite a bit of contact with her. She was not particularly pretty, although she had a very nice personality, and had a very beautiful pair of legs. And so since her name was Mrs. Legler, she was lovingly known among the graduate students as Legs Legler. She typed most of our theses, and in those days, of course, there was no computers and there was no Xerox. So there were many, many carbon copies on onion skin prepared. And obviously, when an error was found, rather than the very simple way of correcting it nowadays, it was necessary to either retype the page or, as she frequently did, simply insert the corrected sentence between the lines of the thesis or along the edge of the thesis. And apparently that was acceptable even to the librarian who had to accept our thesis. And incidentally, discussing the question of politics in the department, Mrs. Legler was an expert at the politics. After we all graduated, she sent a newsletter to a number of us describing the activities of the department and the activities of the individuals and the faculty. Many of the new faculty that arrived after we left were objects of her pointed comments, and she would leave no doubt as to the politics that were involved in the operation of the department at that time. Unfortunately, I was not privy to her conversations. I only indirectly saw some of her newsletters, but she certainly was aware of all the political maneuvers of the department. Well, finally, I should say that I thank you very much for the opportunity to make this tape and to describe the events that have meant so much to my life and to my professional career, because I do feel that the University of Wisconsin was the major contributor in helping me to achieve what little fame I may have achieved in chemistry, certainly a satisfying career in academic chemistry, and in research as a research institute vice president, and finally now as a retired member of the chemical profession. Thank you for listening to this. I hope some of this information may be of value to you. If I can be of any further service or provide any further details, do not hesitate to give me a telephone call at area code 210-492-4290. This is Monday, January the 17th, 1994, and as you can see, only a few days before my 68th birthday. Thank you very much for listening.